Pete mentioned the topic of anonymity, and it's such a personal issue, but I do like to make note of one important aspect of anonymity. It is the spiritual foundation of our program, but please, never, if you can, allow it to come between you and your ability to help another human being. Don't be too anonymous. Akron in 1935 was a city divided into itself. It's the headquarters of three of the largest tire companies in the world, Goodyear, Goodrich, and Firestone. It was our intention, myself and some investors, to take over a small little machine company that was supplying all three. It was a real plum if we could get it. Now, our intent was to do it by proxy. And to do that, you had to get some inside information. But as I said, the town was so divided with these three major companies that nobody, and I mean nobody, spoke to each other. If you worked for Goodyear, you didn't have any Firestone or Goodrich friends, and vice versa. And here we were, a bunch of New Yorkers come into town to take over one of their pet companies. So nobody cooperated with us. We couldn't get an inside track to work on. That's what you need if you're going to win a proxy battle. And then another group, a rival group, came in from Chicago, and as they were Midwesterners, they had the inside track, and they wound up winning the proxy battle. We lost. And my investors decided to go back to New York and call it quits. They had something to go back, though, and I didn't. This was my chance, as this had been successful, to really turn my life around. I was to be made president of that company, and with a handsome salary, sufficient to get me out of debt and get Lois out of that damn department store. But here we were, we had failed. But I asked them if they'd allow me to stay for a few days to sort of reconnoiter and find out if there was any malfeasance or misfeasance on behalf of the winning company. And if there was, we could sue them for the illegality and perhaps get back our expenses with maybe even a little profit. My partners had nothing to lose. The hotel was paid forward for a few days, so they said, go ahead. If you want to stay, that's up to you. And they left, and I stayed behind. And that's how I found myself that Saturday in May 1935, day before Mother's Day, walking up and down the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, pacing. At one end was the desk clerk, and at the other end was the hotel bar. And I just walked backwards and forwards, waiting for Monday, waiting to go to work. Feeling very, very sorry for myself because it was a failure. Mine was a last gasp. Finally, I found myself no longer pacing, but I was standing outside of a bar, and I was listening to the noises that a bar makes and all the nostalgia that it was creating inside of me. And finally, I decided that I'd go in and have a glass of ginger ale and strike up a conversation, thereby passing the day. And as soon as I said it, I realized what had happened to me on that trip to Staten Island. I realized further that I didn't want a glass of ginger ale. I wanted to get drunk. I had $10 in my pocket. And believe me, $10 in those days, you could be king for a day in Akron with $10. But also, I had been sober long enough, or without a drink long enough, to realize that I should be frightened by the way I was thinking. And I was frightened. I was rationalizing it. That frightened me. And then I thought, well, what's been keeping me sober? Why am I sober if I can still think this way? And I further realized that it was working with drunks, working with other men like myself, that kept me from drinking. That's what had worked. Even though they didn't get sober, I stayed sober. And I said, if I could find a drunk to work on, by God, I need him more than he needs me. I need to find a drunk to talk to. But I was a stranger in town. I knew nobody. I couldn't go into the bar and ask somebody if they wanted my help. They'd beat me up. I went back to pacing. And then after a few minutes, for no reason that I know of, I found myself reading a church directory in the center of the hotel lobby. And at the bottom of the directory, there was one name that just leapt out at me. The Reverend Walter Tunks. As a boy growing up in Vermont, when we took a walk in the woods, we took a tunk. And that was hunch enough for me. I bet on that hunch. I went over and I dropped a nickel into the phone and I dialed, and the Reverend Tunks answered the phone. And for those of you that are bowlers, it was what you'd call a 10 strike. I had called the number one fan of the Oxford groups in Akron, Ohio. I told him my plight, what I wanted, that I was a rum hound from New York, here on business, that I'd been sober for 6 months, I was a member of the Oxford group, and I think I could help another drunk. Did he know any? Well, he was at first hesitant. He could deal with drunks one at a time. He didn't know if he could handle them two at a time. But finally he said, I don't know any drunks, I'm sorry. He said, but even if I did, in confidence, I couldn't share their names. But I do know members of the Oxford group. Here, let me give you their names and numbers. And with that, he gave me 10 names of 10 members of the Oxford group. I went and cashed a dollar, and I got 20 nickels. I went back to the phone booth, and I sat down, and I began to dial those numbers. I went through the first 9 in a matter of maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And they were either not home, or they knew nobody that I could help, or they hung up on me. Simple as that. Finally, I was down to my last name, and I took a deep breath, and I dropped the nickel in, and I caught a man who was busy packing his bags, leaving town for the weekend. He was already late. And I told him my story, and he listened. He said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I don't know any. But he said, here, call this woman. Perhaps she can help you. And he gave me her name. And my heart sank. Her name was Henrietta Seiberling. I said, my God, this has got to be Frank Seiberling's wife, the fellow that started Goodyear. I knew him. We were members of the same clubs in New York. I couldn't call him up and say, hey, this is Bill Wilson. Do you remember me from New York? I'm now a drunk. Do you know any drunks, or does your wife know any drunks that I could help? I couldn't call him. I just couldn't put myself to do it. The more I sat in that booth thinking about this, the more I realized that if I didn't, I'd get drunk. Finally, taking another deep breath, I dropped the nickel in, and I dialed the number. And Henrietta answered. Henry, we call her. I told her my story and what I wanted. And all she said was, come right over. And she gave me the address. And I came right over. She wasn't Frank Seiberling's wife. She was his daughter-in-law, soon to be ex-daughter-in-law. She was in the process of divorcing the young heir. She was living in the gatehouse. She wasn't in a mansion. She was down by the side of the road. She had moved there so her children could be close to their father. She had embraced the Oxford group several years before when this divorce process began to get the help that they offered. You see, the Oxford group was not a religion. It was a non-denominational fundamental movement that sort of tried to practice a kind of Christianity they felt belonged shortly after the death of Christ, in the years right after the death of Christ, when there was no hierarchy and there were no rules or regulations. It was just people helping people through all types of crises and helping with their faith. That's more or less what the Oxford group was. They met together, they shared, they had gatherings. We call them house parties or drawing room conversations. And people just prayed and meditated together and helped each other through difficult spots. And that's what Henry had joined it a couple of years before when she got into the divorce process. And they had helped her a great deal, and she was very active in the movement. And only 2 weeks before my visit to Akron, before my call to her, at one of their sharings, a doctor, a well-known surgeon in Akron, told his group that he had a drinking problem. It was his deepest, darkest secret, and he shared it with the group. Yet everybody in town knew it. Everybody in town knew that Dr. Bob Smith had a problem with alcohol. But to him, it was a deep, very, very deep, dark secret. Bob used to tell us of himself. There was a joke in the medical societies that, you see, he was a rectal surgeon, a proctologist. They had an inside story about him that you bet your ass when you went to Bob Smith because you never knew if he was going to be drunk or sober. And yet, when he shared this, he was sharing his soul. Well, Henry, because she was especially fond of Bob and of his wife, she took to praying for him. He became very, very active in her prayers. She asked God to help him. And then, out of the blue, she gets a call from me saying that I can help drunks. And all she could say was, this is manna from heaven, come right over. And I came over and she interviewed me. She interviewed me to find out if I wasn't indeed a drunk. Now, I've had interviews in my life where I had to prove I wasn't a drunk. And here I was trying to prove to a total stranger that I did indeed have a problem with alcohol. And when she was convinced, she went over to the phone and she called Ann Smith and said, Ann, I've got a fellow here from New York that can help drunks. Bring Bob over. And Ann hemmed and hawed for a few minutes and came up with a couple of lame excuses about why they couldn't come over, but Henry would hear none of it. She finally wore her down until Ann had to tell the truth. She said, Henry, we can't come over. Bob came home this afternoon with a potted plant for me for Mother's Day and put it on the kitchen table. And now, as he's more potted than the plant, he's under the table. I couldn't wake him up if his life depended on it. Well, Henry wasn't going to be put off by that. She said to her, listen, Ann, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get this fellow to come back tomorrow. You bring Bob over for dinner tomorrow at 5 o'clock, and we'll get these two fellows together. And she asked me if I could come over, and I said, certainly. I had no place to go until Monday morning. So I went back to the hotel, passed a peaceful night. The next day, I walked around town for a while, and then eventually walked out to that lovely little gatehouse on Portage Road to meet my friend, Bob Smith. First look I got at him, he was a mess. Absolute mess, coming off a drunk. I guess I said the right thing. I said, I bet you could use a drink. That sort of softened him up a little bit. I guess he said, here's a guy that knows what he's talking about. We went immediately into the dining room to begin supper, but Bob was shaking so badly at the table, the food scattering all over the place, that I took sympathy for him, and I said, come on, we can eat later. Let's go in and have a chat. And I could see he was grateful. He knew what he looked like, and he knew how he was acting. So we got up, and we went into a little study, or a library, if you want to call it, that little tiny room that Henry kept, and Bob and I sat down to talk. Now, on the way over, he said to Annie, his wife, he said, I'll give this bum 15 minutes, and then you come in and announce that there's been a train wreck or a plane wreck, but get me out of there. He would do anything she wanted him to do when he was coming off a drunk, but he did have limitations, and there wasn't anybody from New York could sober him up. Well, before we began, I recall what Dr. Silkworth had said, and I began to practice that advice. But I started off by saying to him, Doc, I said, I need your help. He was taken aback a minute, and he said, what do you mean, need your help? I thought you were going to help me. And I said, no, I truly need your help. If I don't talk to you, I'll get drunk. And following Silky's advice, I told Bob my story, blow by blow. And he listened and shook his head, nodded. Every once in a while, he'd say something himself. And I talked about the disease of alcoholism to a man who was in medicine for over 30 years. And he listened to every word I said because it was all news to him. And that 15 minutes lasted for 5 hours. And when it was over, we went outside, and returning to the ladies, he put his arm around my shoulder and he said to his wife, Ann, he said, honey, can we bring him home with us? I think he can help me. And she said, sure. A few days later, when my bill had run out at the hotel, I moved into Ardmore Avenue with Ann and Bob Smith and their children, Sue and Bob Jr. I was given young Bob's bed. He was put on a cot. I was made Uncle Bill to the children right away. And the love and the joy and the beauty and the grace and the wonder that came out of that hallowed home, I will never find equaled again on the face of the earth. Every morning we would, the three of us, Ann, Bob, and I, would go up to a little sewing room that she kept upstairs, and we'd sit after breakfast and say our prayers and read from the good book and meditate and share for an hour. And I always ended with Annie saying, faith without works is dead. And I'd go off to work to find out if there was anything done illegal to us, which there never was. And Bob would go off to whatever practice he had left, and Ann would stay home, keeping house and watching the children. And then in the evening we'd come back, have dinner, and then Bob and I would go to an Oxford group meeting, or if there were none, we'd go for a walk, and we'd talk, and we'd share, and we'd talk about this, the significance of one alcoholic helping another, and perhaps there was great merit to this, and that perhaps we could set up a kind of a chain reaction, helping other people. And after a couple of weeks, Bob got sober. It was wonderful, truly wonderful. Then one morning at breakfast, he announced to Ann and I that he was going to attend the AMA convention in Atlantic City. He hadn't missed one in 30 years, and he wasn't going to miss one now that he was sober. And Annie begged him, please don't go. You know what those things turn out to be. And he said, no, honey, I've got to go. I've got to prove that this works. This fella, pointing to me, he can't stay in Akron forever. He's got to go back and get a job. And he was right. The deal was dead. I had to go home and look for work. He said, I've got to go test this out, and if it works, then he can leave. And I agreed finally. That was a good idea. Let's see if he could fly. And Bob left for Atlantic City, and as he told the story, he began drinking as the train pulled out of the station. We found him 5 days later. One of his ex-nurses and her husband had found him in a bar in downtown Akron and brought him home to their house in a suburb north of the city. And they tried to get him sober, but he only got worse, so finally, in desperation, they called us to get him and bring him home. I was heartbroken. On the ride over, I was just sick at heart. Annie, though, said, Bill, would you please, could you stay and help me get him well again, because he has an operation to perform in a few days, and if he fails to do that, we will lose the operating theater, and if we lose that theater, we're going to lose the hospital, and it's the only one left in town that will allow him to practice. If he loses that, we have to go bankrupt. That's how bad they were. That's how broke they were. And for her sake, I agreed to do it. And we brought him home, and he was a mess. And after gallons of coffee, and I used to have a hangover cure, I even tried to get it patented once, cold sliced tomatoes, sauerkraut juice, and carob syrup. We shovel that down his throat. Whatever stayed down, I guess, got him sober. And walked him up and down Ardmore Avenue in front of the house. And after a few days, Bob got well. Well enough, anyway, to go in and do the operation. I drove him in. Driving in, he was shaking so badly, I stopped and got him a bottle of beer. I said, here, take this to steady your nerves. And he drank it down. He was grateful. We got to the hospital, and he got out, and he was walking up the steps when all of a sudden he stopped, and he returned to the car, and he leaned down, looked in the window, and he said to me, I'm going to go through with it. I said, go through with it? What do you think I've been around here for? I mean, I was sick of him. I really was. I go through with it. Go ahead. Get it over with. And he left, and I drove home to wait for him to call for me to come and get him. That was 7 o'clock in the morning. 10 o'clock came, and there was no Bob. 12 o'clock, no Bob. 2 o'clock, no Bob. I made arrangements to get a train that evening to go back to New York. He was drunk. Forget about it. Ann was brokenhearted. 5 o'clock, we heard a cab pull into the driveway. Ann went over and peered through the curtains, and she said, it's him. I said, how does he look? And she said, I can't tell. Finally walked in the door, and he put his bag down, and there's that pregnant moment, that pause. You spouses of us, you know the regiment. You know what it's like. There was that pause when nobody can say a word. And then finally Annie said, Honey, where have you been? We've been worried sick. Where had he been? He'd been all over the city of Akron to everybody and to anybody that he had ever harmed or to whom he owed money to. He made amends to each and every one of them, telling them all that he was an alcoholic. And that's what he meant when he said he was going through with this. He was beginning to practice one of those steps that we had taken from the Oxford group. And that was the 10th of June in 1935, and he never drank again. And I didn't go home to New York that night. I stayed. I was so happy. The next morning he said to me, you know, Willie, you and I are not going to stay sober talking to each other. We needs must find another drunk to help. Are you game? Can you stay a little while longer? And I said, sure. I was so thrilled. He went over to the phone and he picked it up and he called the Akron Hospital. He said, hey, he said, I have a fellow here from New York that's got a cure for drinking. Is there anybody down there we can talk to? And the smart aleck nurse said, what about you, Doc? Well, he has. He said, are you sober? He said, yes. Well, that's good enough for me. She said, we have a fellow right now, young Southern boy, lawyer, used to be part of the city council. We got him tied down in bed. He just blackened the eyes as a head nurse. Been on a terrible drunk. He's going to be committed to the Ohio State Hospital when he gets out of here. Self-committed. Will he do? And Smitty said, yes, he'll do fine, thank you. Give him some sedatives and we'll be down by and by. And then without my realizing or knowing anything about it, he had the man put into a private room so we could get him out of the ward and talk to him in private. At his expense. And that evening we went down and we met the man in the bed. Now, in those days, when you were taken out of a ward and put in a private room, it meant usually only one thing. You were dying. When we showed up, this fellow was frightened out of his wits. I mean, the sweat was pouring off his body. He was tied into the bed. I mean, if he could sunk through the mattress, he would have. His eyes were bulging out of his head. And when we stepped in the door, as far as he was concerned, we were two undertakers come to measure the body. He was that frightened. It took us a minute or so to reassure him that we weren't what he thought we were. Finally, he settled down, and we each of us told him our story about what it was like, what happened, and what it was like, which is what we were doing right now. And he listened, the eyes going one to the other, one to the other, his arms outstretched, tied to each side of the bed, looking up at us. And you could see the peace of God settling over him as he began to realize that indeed he wasn't dying. Finally, when we finished, we said, what do you think? And looking up at us, he said, gee, fellas, I'm happy for both of you, but it's too late for me. I wish you all the luck in the world, but I'm a goner, he said. I dare not leave here. I'll kill somebody on my next drunk. I'm sure of it. I've asked to be committed into the Ohio State Hospital. It's too late for me, but I wish you all the luck in the world. He said, I didn't give up on God. God gave up on me. Well, we couldn't fight that. We had no tools to combat that. We turned to go. And I don't know to this day if it was Bob or I, but one of us went back to the bed and said, listen, maybe we missed something. Could we come back and talk to you again, perhaps to spend a few more minutes? Maybe we could cover some other points. And he said, oh, please do. Please come back. If it helps you, absolutely, come back. He said, you know how lonely this drying out gets. They don't come near us from one minute of the day to the next, he said. They hate us. They hate the sight of us. They hate the sound of us. They hate the smell of us. Oh, please come back. Please, I'd like it if you would. Well, we had a half a sale. It wasn't a complete sale, but we could talk to him again, and we felt good about that. We left. A few days later, we came back, and now this time he's back in the ward. He's not in a private room. We stepped into the doorway, and he spots us. He's sitting up in bed talking to his wife. And he lets out a roar, there they are! I mean, he screamed so loudly, there was a fellow, I think, that had certified as dead, got up and left. A nurse dropped her tray. We rushed down, trying to quiet him down. He was jumping up and down, saying over and over again, it wasn't a dream. It wasn't a dream. These are the men that I was talking about. There was somebody pointing to us. These men did come to see me. He had thought it all was a figment of his drunken imagination. He pointed to me. He said to his wife, honey, this man, he said, he's a stockbroker. Come here on business. Come to see me. He's a drunk just like me. And pointing to Smitty, he said, and this guy, he said, honey, he's a hiney doctor right here in the hospital. Come to see me. Tell her, he said, tell her what you told me. I haven't been able to get the sight of you two men out of my mind. Tell her what you told me. And we each of us in turn told her again our stories. And throughout our whole telling, he kept saying over and over again, see, I told you, I told you. And when we finished, he said, honey, get my clothes, I'm going home. And his name was Bill D, AA number 3. And we had our first group. We were 3. That still meets today. Still meets in Akron. We had something. And what made it most important is we had somebody that wasn't a member of the Oxford group. He was a stranger to it, and yet he understood what it is we were talking about. It was a wonderful time to be alive. 2 years later, there was 40 of us. Most of them in Akron and some with me in New York. 40 men, sober, 6 months or more. We listed their names one night at the kitchen table back in Akron. I was there on business. Bob said, you know, the rate we're going, we'll have 1,000 by the year 2000. We must organize. We must get this spread around a lot better. And for that, we need money. And Bill, you're the expert in the money. You better raise some money because we've got to get this message across. And I went and tried to raise money, and that's another story and another night, but it was a disaster. Finally, somebody suggested that we write a book. If you want to make money, write a book. Well, we borrowed some money and begged some money and sold some small trusts that we had, and we opened up the Works Publishing Company, and we set about writing a book. None of us with any experience at all in doing just that. I wrote my chapter, a few other words, and Bob wrote his, and Silky contributed some, and members both in New York and Akron and Cleveland wrote their stories, and we had the makings of a book. We had something we thought could sell. The only ingredient missing was how it worked. None of us, and I mean none of us, clearly understood how it worked. Sure, we had 6 steps. We had taken the 5 original ones, and we added the first one, of course, which were powerless over alcohol and that our lives were unmanageable. But that's all we had. We had no really process or something to speak about. Whenever anybody would ask us, how does this thing work, we all would just say, fine, it works fine. How does it work? One evening, a group of fellas, myself included, were sitting around our place in Brooklyn Heights, my brother-in-law's place. Lois was still working in that damn department store, drinking her coffee, feet up on her furniture, and we were talking about how it works and what we had to put into this book, because the book had to get published. We were broke, absolutely, totally broke, and we were in debt. Bob, the worst of all of us, he was going to lose everything. We're sitting around, and we were talking up the idea that if we were going to make it a bestseller, we needs must keep God out of it. This was 39 now, and this is the year that the World's Fair opened up, and it was the world of tomorrow, and science was selling. Anything on science was selling. So we'd make it a scientific book. We wouldn't make it a religious book or a spiritual book. We'd downplay that and talk about science. And I was in agreement. I mean, I wanted to get something to sell because we needed the money. And Lois came home from work, and while she was in making another pot of coffee, she overheard this conversation. And then all of a sudden, there was a loud crash in the kitchen, and she came out, and she was so angry, she threw everybody out of the house. Everybody. With the exception of me. I lived there. And finally she came over to me, and in her anger, she pointed her finger up into my nose, and she said, Mister, you're going to get drunk. She was quivering. You're going to get drunk. I said, what makes you say that? Because you forgot who got you sober. With that, she left, went upstairs. I'd never seen her that angry before, so I wasn't going to follow her. I just let her cool off, and I stayed downstairs. And we used to have a little room underneath the staircase that I like to go in and do my meditating in. I went in and I lay down on a cot there, and I began to think about what she had said. Forgot who got me sober. And I began to think back in all the moments in my life when there was something that was outside of myself that gave me direction and help. I began to think of all the truths that we had learned from the Oxford group and all the things that Bob had shared with me over the 4 years. Finally, I reached up and I took down the clipboard that I kept over the bed, and I began to write. And when I finished, I had taken those 6 ideas that we had, and I cut them up into smaller pieces until finally I had 12 steps. And in the 2nd step, I identified God, and the 3rd step, I called him by name. And I stopped at number 12 for only one reason. There had been 12 apostles, so I figured if that was good enough for him, it would be good enough for us. I got up and I came out of the room, and as it happened, a couple of fellows had come back to the house and were finishing up Lois's coffee, sitting up in the parlor, and I sat down with them. And now, I knew that the book had to be published, and this had to be going to it, and we had to get it done. So I was not going to book an argument. Although we operated from group conscience, I knew that this had to be done this way. So I told them that this is what we were going to go forward with. And I read them the 12 steps. And they listened and they said, no argument, Bill. No argument. And the one lad said, would you mind, though, if if you would add that whenever you use the word God, would you also say, as we understood him? And I said, okay. And we had 12 steps, and we had a book. The only thing missing was a title. I, in all modesty, suggested the Bill Wilson movement, but that got shot down right away. Somebody else has suggested The Way Out, and I like that. That had a neat ring to it. But we had a friend going down to Washington on a business trip, and he checked in with the patent office, and it turned out that there were already 12 titles, The Way Out. We didn't want to be number 13. So we went back to the drawing boards. Now, there were 100 men sober then in 1939, so somebody suggested, let's call it 100 men. And that had another nice ring to it, and I thought that'd be great. And wouldn't you know it, the first woman showed up. We couldn't say 100 men plus a woman, because people would say, what happened to women? So we went back to the drawing boards. Then one night at a meeting, they brought a fellow in from Bellevue, and just almost out of his mind, and he was babbling throughout the whole meeting, anonymous alcoholics, anonymous alcoholics. Finally, I had to pick him up and bring him back to the hospital, where he eventually died. And I liked the ring of that, and so did some other people. But then, when we were going to call the book Anonymous Alcoholics, somebody said, no, put the alcoholic first. Put him first. So we named the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which became the name of our society. And we printed 5,000 copies and sold 102. The girl bought 2. Couldn't give them away, but again, that's another night and another story. And please invite me back if you want to hear about it. It's a lot of laughs. But today now we're 100,000. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of these books we have sold. But we began to grow. Thank God. Now this book, it's merely a suggestion. We don't have all the answers. Believe me, we don't. Just see to it, you know, when you say your prayers in the morning, ask God, what can I do for the guy or the gal that is still suffering? And the answers will come if your own house is in order. But trust me, you can't give away what you don't have. See to it that your relationship with him is right. You know, turn yourself over to his care. Admit your faults to another. Clear away all the damage you've done in your life. And be active. Help other people. And have a full, wholesome, beautiful life. AA is an utter simplicity encased in a mystery that nobody, I mean nobody, understands perfectly. Least of all I. Nobody understands it. Our strength comes from our weakness, the fact that we know what we are. We know our weakness. That's where we gain our strength. We need to achieve some form of humility before we're going to have any kind of a resurrection. And pain, nobody likes the word, but pain is not only the price we have to pay, it's the touchstone of any spiritual rebirth. This group is celebrating its first anniversary. I really mean this. Be grateful for that. And be grateful for the experience that it's brought about. But don't depend upon it for one minute for the needs of today. The art of life is to live one minute, one day, one moment at a time. And to make that moment, that day, as perfect as you can. I want to thank you I'm beginning to preach now, so I want to stop. I want to thank you for allowing me to share some of the moments of our life, yours and mine, because you're all a part of it. And I realize now that my friends, my wife, were right when they said that I should come here tonight and share our story. It has done me a world of good. I would hope that you... Where did I put my coat? Oh, here it is. I would hope that you would invite me back again when I come back from Akron, because I will need your support more than ever then. I miss him already. You know, Bob and I, we were both from Vermont. He was raised 50 miles away from my home. He's 15 years my senior. He was from an aristocracy. His father was a judge. We were country bumpkins. I was born in a saloon. He was a physician, Bob. He was trained to accept people the way they were and to work with them as they were. Me, all my life, I'm a promoter, a seeker. I've been always reaching out for something new. My spirituality, my quest for truth is something that has hounded me. But Bob, my friend, he was always nearer to the truth. Nearer to the truth of things. Nearer to the power I sought. He found it in his simple approach to life. And I think that placed him closer to our Creator than any man I've ever known. I guess that was needed to get this thing going. Bob's simple inner life and mine, to which I guess nothing is ever going to be simple. I'm grateful that I was able to be in Akron this weekend with Bob. We had some piece of business, AA business, that you're going to hear more about in the springtime to do with the Board of Trustees. I went out to talk to him about it. For those of you who were at the convention in Cleveland last July, you witnessed his last talk. You'll never hear a finer speech in all the history of AA, where he could take these 12 steps and cut them down to two words, love and service. It's beyond me. But that was what Bob could do. Bob was a surgeon. He was always able to cut things down to size. Well, I was with him, and I want you to know, although he was in a great deal of pain and a great deal of suffering, I had all his attention. I had all of his energy and all of his calm reassurance. People have said to me over the years, you know, Bill, you're the heart of AA. If I'm the heart of AA, then Bob was its soul and the blood of my heart. Well, anyway, when the meeting was over, I had to go catch a train back to New York, and I walked out, and he followed me. As we got by the hall closet, he stopped for a minute. He said, wait a minute, Bill, he said, here. And he reached up into the closet, and he took down this here, this old Irish country hat that he'd worn so many years, and he handed it to me. He said, here, Bill, put this on, wear it. It's raining outside, and I don't want you to get sick. You've got too much work to do. Now, for those of you that are not aware of it, there's a history between Bob and I on this hat. I have wanted it for 15 years. This is the first day I laid eyes on it. I swiped it a number of times. Lois kept mailing it back to him. But here he was giving me this, his favorite hat. I just couldn't say a word. I said, maybe I'll keep my mouth shut, or she'll change his mind. And I turned and I went, and I was walking down the path to the cab, and for some reason, I turned back, and he had followed me out on the porch. He was standing there, and he had that beautiful, broad grin of his, and he was smiling. And all he said to me is, don't louse this thing up, Bill. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. My God, he'd been saying that forever. This is my friend, my partner for 15 years, a man I never had a hard word with. And he said, keep it simple. I turned away, little realizing that it was going to be the last time I would see him alive. And I didn't know it. I wish I had. And then tonight, coming here to talk to you, I reached up into my hall closet to take down this hat. It was only then I realized that although I didn't know it, Bob knew it. You see, it wasn't raining in Akron that night. He just found a loving, simple way to say goodbye. And in so doing, showing me again how simple this program was. All we do is pass things on. Thank you. Good night. God bless you.